Winston Churchill once said about the reconstruction of the House of Commons when it was in the process of being rebuilt. He said this: "We shape our buildings, and thereafter they shape us." As someone who works with architects designing and renovating spaces for worship, I think this is profoundly true, but it might be revised this way. We build our churches, and they inform our ideas about God and God's people. Now, we may not always be conscious or always conscious of how the shape and the design and furnishings of the places in which we, week after week, celebrate sacred liturgies. Yet, I can confidently affirm that from the largest elements to the smallest details, these spaces inform and convey our understanding of why we come and what we do there. The design and decoration of our worship spaces communicate to us non-verbally in powerfully effective ways. They are much more than mere shelters for the activity. We rarely pay attention to them for themselves, but they are silent visual symbols that partner with the audible embodied words we sing and say and pray. In other words, church buildings are far more than functional containers for our rituals, designed to conveniently accommodate the directions laid out in our liturgical books. They are icons that express the significance and purpose of our rituals. Moreover, they're communal icons, as well as personal or private devotional aids. We share them. We inhabit them together. They are the places where we encounter the sacred presence, and they are spaces of holy memories. I'm going to get off my text for a minute and tell you a story. So some of my time I've been on the board of the Journal of the Architects Institute of America called Faith and Form, and so I get to work sometimes with communities that are renovating their spaces or building new worship spaces. And architects inevitably say that this is the hardest thing they have to do is designing a church, because people bring their memories to this. So if you're in New England and you're a Congregationalist, you want a white church with it looks like, you know, the church that we do with the little thing with our children. But if you're in Minnesota and you're a Lutheran, you want something that's yellow brick with a swooping thing, because that's what you had when you grew up. So there's so much memory engaged in churches, and people think there's only one way to build one, because it's the one that they went to or the one that they loved when they were children. They say, architects say, this is harder than designing people's houses, because you also have to design for a whole lot of people's memories, and that's really tricky. So when I say that, I mean that. Now, that ecclesiastical authorities should take care that their buildings be upliftingly beautiful as well as appropriately functional is laid out in church documents. For example, a paragraph in Chapter 7 of the document issued by the Second Vatican Council, the Sacrosanctum Concilium, reads, and you see it here, "During their philosophical and theological studies, clerics are to be taught about the history and development of sacred art and about the sound principles governing the production of its works. In consequence, they will be able to appreciate and preserve the church's venerable moments and be in a position to aid, by good advice, artists who are engaged in producing works of art." Now, that's all very tricky, because everybody has a different sense of what is sacred and what's beautiful. Sometimes we get down to a matter of taste. And so we can talk about beauty, but sometimes we don't always know what that really looks like on the ground. I tell my friends in theological aesthetics this all the time, and they kind of bristle, and I'm saying, you go around talking about beauty, but I know, and I agree with you, but I want to know what that really looks like. And so that's the tricky part. Here we are on Earth, and not in one of the transcendentals. Now, as most of us know, the changes in the liturgy prescribed by the Second Vatican Council profoundly affected the architectural environment that housed them. While the council did not say or did not offer any specific instructions about this in the records of their proceedings, certain details were outlined in the subsequent implementation documents that were promulgated in the following decades, among them, and perhaps most authoritatively, the General Instruction on the Roman Missal, first published in 1969. And I will refer to that document in a little while, in some further comments. But before I go too far into the weeds here, I should explain that the last half century of evolution in the design and furnishing of Roman Catholic churches is a huge and admittedly controversial topic, and too much for one night's lecture. Tonight, I will simply pay attention to two important focal points in any Roman Catholic church, which is also true of any other churches, probably Protestants included, and show how the physical changes in these two, the altar and the baptismal font, have parallels in the way the council documents drew upon certain ancient Christian practices as their source and basis, a programmatic movement often known as ressourcement, resourcing. So let me start with the font, the symbol of our beginning. As many here tonight will know, or concretely remember, the shape and depth and placement of Catholic baptismal fonts began to dramatically change around the last quarter of the 20th century. Parishes started installing large pools at the backs of their churches, replacing the traditional small pedestal fonts designed for pouring water over infants' heads. These changes, along with liturgical reforms of the ritual of baptism, directed by the Second Vatican Council, had partly resulted in a development that most Catholics now call by its shorthand name, the RCIA, the Rite of Christian Initiation in Adulthood. So now we have adults being baptized in immersion fonts. The RCIA, promulgated by the Vatican and approved by the Pope in 1972, was part of the call of the Second Vatican Council to restore the adult catechumenate. The Latin edition was prepared in 1974, and a provisional English translation appeared in 1974. Emendations were incorporated in 1983, and the final version was canonically approved by the National Council of Catholic Bishops in 1986, and that was confirmed by the Apostolic See by decree of the Congregation for Divine Worship in 1987. I'm just giving you all the weeds here so you know that kind of what the history of this is a little bit. With respect to initiatory rituals for unbaptized or unconfirmed adults, theologians then turned to the primitive church for models. There they found practices for the rite of election, the signing of catechumens with the cross, text for the Lenten scrutinies, dismissal of candidates before the Eucharistic service, the solemn transmission of the Creed and the Lord's Prayer, the Ephetha rite, the inclusion of adult baptism at the Easter Vigil, and even the practice of mystagogical reflection in the Sundays following Easter. This was all developed at this time, but it drew upon the early church practices, or at least in a certain theoretical way they did. We can kind of argue about some of it, but historians of liturgy mined documents from early Christian sermons to ancient church orders from which they adapted almost forgotten practices for contemporary initiation rites. However, if one examines the many books of instruction on how and when to perform the renewed rites of Christian initiation in adulthood, and I am one of those, I am an RCIA representative here, the where seems to be missing. Very little was said about the design or structural material of the baptismal font, and the documents offer only vague references to the font's placement, depth, or adornment. The relevant paragraph in the Sacrosanctum Concilium simply said that the font or baptistry should be practical and dignified. Okay. The subsequent Vatican document laying out the ritual, the rite of Christian initiation and adulthood, added that the font should be in view of the faithful. A subsequent document promulgated by the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops in the late 1970s recommends that the font should allow for immersion of adults or pouring of water over the whole body of a child. This is from Environmental and Art and Christian Worship. That should be installed, they say, somewhere near the entrance to the church to instantiate the fact that baptism is, in fact, how one actually enters the body of the faithful. And, it added, it should have living or moving water. They didn't specify cold, but it's my problem with the Notre Dame Basilica. It has warm water. It drives me crazy. All right, anyway. Although the recommendation for an immersion font had ancient precedents, the font's placement at the church entrance, not so much. The earliest fonts were designed to accommodate baptism of adult converts, because that's what they had, but they were located in a variety of places and usually enclosed in separated chambers or freestanding buildings, not installed in the center of the nave. And this is like the earliest baptismal font we actually have, other than the one in Syria at Dura Europus, and is, of course, the baptismal font that's attached to the Lateran Basilica built by the Emperor Constantine in the early quarters, the first quarter of the fourth century. And it was built pretty much like this. It was built to be an octagonal freestanding building. Among all the church documents relevant to implementing the renewed rite, one source, built of living stones from the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, around 2000 edition, initially reiterates the significant symbolism of the baptismal font's placement toward the church's entrance. Then, for the first time, it mentions historical or traditional models for the font and refers to ancient church practices and font design. Okay, here we are. First, regarding where the font should be placed. The rites of baptism, the first of the sacraments of initiation, require a prominent place for celebration. Initiation into the church is entrance into a Eucharistic community united in Jesus Christ. Because the rites of initiation of the church begin with baptism and are completed in the reception of the Eucharist, the baptismal font and its location reflect the Christian's journey through the waters of baptism to the altar. I've added the italics there. The integral relationship between the baptismal font and the altar can be demonstrated in a variety of ways, such as placing the font and the altar on the same architectural axis, using natural or artificial lighting, using the same floor patterns, and using common or similar materials and elements of design. So here's a good example. This is St. James Catholic Cathedral in Seattle. Note where the font is placed, at the entrance to the church, in the midst of the nave and not off to the side, on a direct axis to the altar. What does this symbolize? The incorporation of the new Christians into the body of Christ and their journey to the sacrament of the Eucharist, from the font to the table. This, as I have noted, is not the usual pattern for baptism in antiquity, however, where fonts were often placed in detached buildings or separated chambers attached to sacristies or on one side of the nave. I'm going to give you an example. This is a floor plan for a baptismal font in Carthage. It's a 5th century baptismal font in North Africa, today in Tunisia. And you can see that the font is, my mouse will work here. All right, and this is a very typical placement. This little apsed room is probably what the catechumens used, possibly for confirmation and or for catechetical training. Here is the church. You may remember that, notice where the altar is in this church. I'm going to come back to something like this. This is what it looks like. So it's just kind of, that's why the floor plan helps. Okay. Based on the American bishop's statement, it appears they thought the placement of fonts near the entrance, however, would encourage full congregational participation in the rite, since separated chambers are usually not large enough to accommodate more than a few people at a time. Then we used to have private baptisms, right? So we had people going into smaller spaces. Then, built of living stones, this document took up the historical symbols of baptism.
This is a fourth century church here. And the baptismal font is here.
And here's what it looks like. Oh, I'm going to even give you more. This is actually Augustine's Basilica in Algeria, and this is what's still standing today, and you can see it. So here is the nave. Here is the apse. It's not too clear here, but you can tell that the semicircle. This is a raised level, so the apse was raised. There were some steps down, and the altar was here. And these are the side aisles, and you can come around, and this is where the baptismal font was. It also had its own entrance. I can show you a plan. I will kind of show you how that worked. This is a, my daughter's an architect, so I got her to work on this part. This is an isometric elevation. So here is the basilica, here is the baptismal font, and this is part of maybe the bishop's residence over here, but candidates could come in this door and enter into the baptismal area and come out into the church, like so. And that would be a quick study on that. Now here is this text from 2000. Water is the key symbol of baptism and the focal point of the font. In this water, believers die to sin and are reborn to new life in Christ. Very important point. In designing the font and the iconography in the baptismal area, the parish will want to consider the traditional symbolism that has been the inspiration for the font's design throughout its history. The font is a symbol of both womb and tomb. Its power is the power of the triumphant cross. And baptism sets the Christian on the path to life that will never end, the eighth day of eternity, where Christ's reign of peace and justice is established. So I would even add dying to sin and being born a new life, but it might be womb and tomb. So we've got womb and tomb, cross, and eighth day. So far as I know, this is the first document that mentions ancient tradition of this sort. However, I think that architects or consultants in the liturgical environment who designed and constructed these new baptismal pools were already aware of early Christian fonts and almost certainly drew inspiration from them. So the four baptismal symbols, womb, tomb, cross, and eighth day, that this document describes says inspired fonts designed through history are in fact represented in baptismal fonts, both ancient and modern. Let me show you some examples. The font is a symbol of both womb and tomb. So I don't want to read too much text to you, but this comes from a 4th century document from Zeno of Verona, his Invitations to the Baptismal Font, and suddenly you can sort of quickly scan it and you can see that the image of the font as womb is very prominent here. That you are reborn from this. The mother is the church. The font is her womb. It is where we are born again. And here are some beautiful examples from antiquity, I think, that get at this kind of symbolism. So we might see a lot of round fonts. And I will point out something that I might not remember to tell you. Every font that I know from antiquity is designed to have a canopy over it. They always have four columns or some kind of numbers of columns so that we'll have to imagine some sort of either leather or cloth of canopy. And it's my contention, I'm not sure, I won't change my mind about this after doing some more work on it, but right now I believe the font is the first place to get a canopy before the altar ever gets one. Really interesting. So here are just some more beautiful photographs of wonderful baptismal fonts in Algeria. This is in Tunisia. This actually probably had a cistern to collect rainwater, and the water came down into the font So we had fresh rainwater and a very arid climate, probably covered so that we could keep the water cool and fresh. In Italy, this one is practically big enough to go swimming in. And this is a beautiful many-columned space for a baptismal font. Notice these are all, each of these is a freestanding or disconnected areas as well. Now, modern versions of that, same shape, just to sort of see them here. This is actually, I give you the outside of this one, and here's the interior. The next image is the cross. The font, I'm sorry, it's the tomb. The font is the tomb where we come to die. This is the next one. And in this text from Cyril of Jerusalem, it is, well, maybe he didn't write this. John might have written this as a debate. But anyway, this text from Jerusalem around the 380s, toward the end of the 4th century, talks about the symbol, the sacred pool of divine baptism is symbolized by the cross. You, as Christ passed from the cross to the sepulcher, This is the tomb. So at the very last part of that quote, you can see in that moment when you were baptized, you were both dying and being born, and the water was your grave and your mother. We don't have so very many rectangular fonts from antiquity. This one is the oldest baptismal font in existence. It's in Syria, and it's based on, I think, very much a burial space. So these are actually tombs, ancient Roman tombs, and this is how this font looks. So I'm comparing that. However, we still sometimes see rectangular baptismal fonts. I actually think they're pretty rare. But this is a Baptist baptismal pool. And I always think it's fun to show this to ecumenical crowds, because if you're Baptist or Church of Christ or Disciples of Christ, you know that baptism is being laid back into the water as opposed to going down into the fetal position, which is very much the way you'd lay a body into a sepulcher, into a coffin. So it's intentional. It's very intentional on the part of those traditions to make it look like a tomb. Okay, now I'm moving on to the cross. I'm going to finally get to the cross. The font's power is the triumphant cross. And so getting a little bit from John Chrysostom, he speaks about, you know, you shouldn't be frightened when you hear the words death and cross. Do you see how baptism, he says, is a cross? Learn that even Christ called baptism the cross when he spoke to the sons of Zebedee, I have a baptism to be baptized with. And baptism is both burial and resurrection at the same time. Now, we have a lot, especially in the East, of beautiful cruciform fonts. This one is in Ephesus. And it's, notice something about it. It allows a place for the assistants, perhaps deacons, to stand while this is a kind of walkthrough font, which has a kind of interesting Celtic cross design, could be a womb and a cross at the same time. And these people can nicely stay dry while they help the fully immersion of the candidates or the catechumens coming through. This is in Turkey. It's in a monastery. And this is probably my favorite one. This is actually also in Tunisia, and this is a cruciform baptismal font that's incredibly deep, also has a division, so that, as you can probably imagine, the water being only in the center axis of this, and you see how deep it actually is. And this is the font at Hippo, the font that Augustine would have used to baptize his converts. One more ancient font in Israel, and now some modern versions of this. Okay. Last, the octagon. The font symbolizes, as we were told by the bishops in their Built of Living Stones document, the eighth day. The first day of the new creation, when Christ reign of peace and justice is established. This is a very, very old shape. If you remember the Lateran baptistry I showed you, it's octagonal. In Milan, Ambrose wrote this text for the baptistry in Milan in the 4th century, late 4th century. He says, the eight-sided temple has risen for sacred purposes. The eight-sided font is worthy for its task. It's seemly the baptismal hall should arise in this number by which true health is returned to the people. And so, Augustine, I gave you some from Augustine's sermon here, and we probably don't have time to read all of this, but notice that he, quickly scanning it, really folds in the idea of once you've passed the sevenfold course of eternity, there is an eighth and eternal felicity. It is why our traditional baptismal fonts are so often octagonal, like this. And believe me, people don't know this, and it's nice for you, little trivia, to know why, if you have an octagonal baptismal font, whether it's what we sometimes call the bird bath font or an immersion font, why the eighth side is so important. It's symbolism. Symbolism. And there we have the Lateran again. And if you went into this Lateran basilica, here's what you'd see inside. A lot has changed since it was built in the 4th century, but these columns that you see, I'm standing at the floor and taking a shot up because what I want you to notice is this inscription on the architrave that's set up in these columns, and the columns go straight up into the cupola, but this has an eight-line poem, and this is what it says. And this poem is attributed, I think, correctly, reasonably correctly, to Leo the Great before he was bishop, while he was still the Archdeacon of Rome, and Sixtus was the bishop. And it has a lot of beautiful language in it. I'm going to quickly sort of read it because I think this is my translation, and I'm sure there's better translations than mine, and we even have to argue about which is the first line, which way you read when you walk around. But a people to be consecrated to the heavens here is born from a fertile seed. So there we have the fertile seed, the birthing imagery again. Established by waters made fruitful by the Spirit. So the Spirit is in some sense impregnating the font. Plunge in, O sinner, to be cleansed by the sacred flow. Whom it receives old, the wave returns new. No differences exist among those being reborn, whom one font, one spirit, and one faith make one. You all are brothers and sisters of the same mother and the same father. By virginal birth, the church, mother church, bears her children, those she conceives by God's breathing. She births in this stream. Wishing to be innocent, wash in the bath, whether you are burdened by ancestral sin or your own. This is the fountain of life, which has cleansed the whole world, taking its origin from Christ's womb. So now we have a reference also to the crucifixion. Hope for the heavenly kingdom once you have been born in this spring, that happy life does not admit those only once born. Let neither the number nor the kind of their sins frighten. Anyone reborn in this river will be holy. Really beautiful text. I could give it to you in Latin. We could spend all night on it, but we're moving on fast. Looking at this baptistry in Milan, and this is an octagonal baptistry. You can't really figure that out too clearly. This is what it looks like. If you could go to Milan now, you can't today, but it's underneath the Cathedral of Milan. It is where Augustine was baptized by Ambrose. And it's kind of wonderful. And so I am married to a person who studies Augustine, and we had to find a way to take away a little stone from this place. We don't want to tell anybody, but a very sacred place. So this is what the cathedral looked like, and here is the baptistry in relationship to the original cathedral, Ambrose's cathedral. And this is the shape of the font interior. And it's an octagonal exterior with an octagonal front, and joined by these beautiful radiating bulbs and niches. And there's so much more to say about how this would have worked, but time is not going to permit us to look at it very much. Just a couple more images from Ravenna, this beautiful mosaic baptistry for the Orthodox community of Ravenna in the middle of the 5th century, or probably a little earlier than that. Its font. This is a font in Timgad, Algeria, probably, if anybody knows what I'm talking about, the font of the Donatus Bishop Optatus of Timgad. Problem. this is in Tebessa in Algeria, another case. But modern versions of this octagonal immersion fonts, of course, plenty of them. And finally, we have a kind of wonderful alternative shape, which is the polylobe. And they're absolutely gorgeous. I sometimes think that these are probably shaped like this because this is how immersion pools were made for Roman baths, and the same people that sort of did the jacuzzi-type bath were just hired to do the baptistries. So, I could talk all night about these fonts, but we don't have time, so I'll just flip by them, and even some of the later ones. And these are also replicated in many of the modern immersion fonts. Okay. Next, second part, the altar. Even more dramatic than the transformation of post-Vatican II font was the change, as you probably realize, in the placement of the altar. Perhaps surprisingly, the Vatican II document, Sacrosanctum Concilium, says very little about the shape, construction, or placement of the altar. However, the general instructions of the Roman Missal from 1975 elaborates. So, here's what some points. The altar on which the Eucharist is celebrated may be fixed or movable. Normally, a church should have a fixed and dedicated altar, freestanding, away from any wall, so the priest can walk around it and celebrate facing the people. I know this is controversial. It should be in a position such that the entire congregation will naturally focus their attention on it. The table of a fixed altar should be made of natural stone. This accords with age-long practice of the church and its own symbolic meaning. A stone altar is a sacrificial altar. I will say that in the early church, we think lots of the altars were actually made from wood in order to contrast with the pagan stone altar that was a sacrificial altar. But nevertheless, the bishop's conference may authorize the use of some other generally accepted and solid material susceptible of good workmanship. The structure supporting the table may be of any material, so long as it's solid and durable. But relics under the altar should be maintained as long as relics are authenticated. Only one altar in a church, or at least few in number inside chapels. Was this a complete innovation? Or was it, too, based on ancient church practices? I'm here to tell you that from the 4th to the 6th century in the East, and somewhat later in the West, altars were almost always freestanding, and sometimes even in the middle of the nave. And while they may have been protected by screens or balustrades, they were rarely, I think almost never, concealed from the laity. They were visible. This is most evident in the churches we can date to the 4th century. Arguably the oldest surviving purpose-built ecclesial buildings. An illustration of this central placement is apparent on a relatively small rectangular mosaic here that was recovered from the excavation of a late 4th century or early 5th century shrine near the coastal town of Tabarka in Tunisia. Originally, it was set over the tomb of a woman named Valentia, who is said now to be at peace. She probably put the money up for building the church. The mosaic depicts a church building, perhaps one whose construction was founded, as I said, by Valentia herself. The legend specifies that the church is mother, a title that echoes the motif of baptism I just discussed, and a very important motif for African Christianity. Church is mother. The altar in the center here, as you can see it, is about a third of the way back in the center of the nave. This is a beautiful schematic, shows the mosaic floor probably. These are the clerestory windows. That's the tile roof. It's like a child's drawing, I realize. My lovely architect daughter, redid this for me in some ways, and so we have this reconstruction. You often see something like this if you look in books, that the altar is here. The bishop's chair would be at the back. Probably the bishop or celebrant would come down the stairs to the Eucharistic table here. I'm going to make more arguments about which position he would have taken at that point. The altar in the center continues in Africa until the mid-6th century, when the Byzantine reconquest brought the area into the orbit of Eastern Christianity. So just a few pictures. You saw this one earlier, and I was trying to show you the baptismal font, and here's where the altar was. There's a palm tree in it now. Here's another case of this. There's the altar. You can see where it's down here. And this is where it's set in this church. Here is the apse. Just more examples. And this finally is no longer, you can't visit this site anymore because it's all been covered up and destroyed by earthquakes and museum professionals. But part of my argument about this is the mosaic you see here, with this centerpiece, and part of my argument is that if the person who was the provider, bishop, presbyter, probably bishop, were to be facing this direction toward the people, it would be upside down. So I do think in this instance, at least, and if not just generally, the idea was the person would come from preaching the sermon, the bishop would come down from the apse area, enter into this area and turn and celebrate in this direction. Because this is where the altar looks. It's probably a depiction of the very altar that was there. So it makes sense. And we can talk more about that. But I think everybody turns and faces the altar in the same direction, the congregation in the same direction as the presider. And here's a detail of that mosaic again. But centrally placed altars were also known in Rome. According to architectural historian Hugo Brandenburg, Rome's Basilica Apostolorum had an altar in the center until the 16th century, following a long-standing tradition that had been in that place from the time of St. Peter. Probably not true, but long tradition. Similarly, Rome's Constantinian churches cited the altar at some point at the place of the meeting point of nave and transept, just probably at the opening of the presbyterium. The altar at the Lateran Basilica, so far as we know, was positioned at this juncture and still stands there today. And we can think about New St. Peter's, where the altar is somewhat in the center, but the first altar of St. Peter's Basilica in the fourth century was movable, and according to Hugo Brandenburg, was probably placed directly in front of Peter's shrine, perhaps right at the opening of the triumphal arch. According to Richard Krautheimer, architectural historian, St. Peter's transept was common ground for both clergy and laity, and the altar would have been, quote, easily accessible to the communicants. Note some important details in that Tabarca mosaic. In addition to the altar's placement and the fact that it is freestanding, notice its shape. It's rectangular. Notice that it has no ciborium, baldacchino, or curtains. And we could ask what material it is. We can't really tell. Could be a tablecloth over it. It could be a stone screen in the front. But ancient evidence indicates that many early altars were often, if not normally, constructed of wood. By tradition, even St. Peter celebrated on an altar of wood, and those remains are still housed in the high altar at the Lateran Basilica. Maybe it's St. Peter's, I'm something. The evidence for wooden altars in Africa include a passage in Optatus's treatise against Parmenion, the Donatus Bishop of Carthage. In it, Optatus reports that in regions where wood was plentiful, the Donatists destroyed their rivals' altars. In the region where wood was scarce, they merely scraped them in their efforts to purify them for use when they took them over for their own churches. Augustine mentions a Donatist attack on the Bishop of Bagai with pieces of wood broken off of the altar of his church, even while he was presiding at it. The use of wood rather than stone, as I've said, may have been intended to distinguish a Christian altar from a pagan one. Because Christian altars were not places for bloody or burnt sacrifices, they did not need to be made of a hard material like stone. Both words, thusisterion, altar, and trapeza, for table, appear in the New Testament in Hebrews 13:10 and 1 Corinthians 10:21. Later, the earliest Latin church documents used both the words altare and mensa, never used the word ara. distinguish, I think, from pagan altars. The transition to stone altars likely happened sometime in the 4th century. While Athanasius of Alexandria refers to wooden altars when describing their destruction by Count Heraclius, a bit later in the 4th century, Gregory of Nyssa mentions an altar of stone. So, probably around that time. Build to living stones one more time. The altar is the natural focal point of the sanctuary and is to be freestanding to allow the priest to walk around it easily, and mass to be celebrated facing the people. And I guess we've sort of already looked at this, so I'm not going to go through this anymore. Go to the bottom where it says, in the United States, it is permissible to use materials other than natural stone for a fixed altar, provided they're solid and worthy and properly constructed, subject to the further judgment of the local ordinary. So let's look at some modern altars, and here we are. This is the one back in Christ the Light Cathedral in Oakland, California. I realize that many Catholics, maybe even some in this audience, are less than happy with the architectural changes of churches that began to appear just prior to, and then in response to, the directives of the Second Vatican Council. My brief lecture tonight does not intend to make an argument about what the best kind of baptismal font might be, or where the altar should be placed in a sanctuary. I have my opinions, but I'm not trying to push them. I merely am trying to show you that there were many varieties from the earliest centuries of the church that parallel many of the choices we see today. And what I do want to emphasize is that whatever choices we make will structure the ways we worship, and more importantly, inform and reflect the meaning of our words and actions as we worship. Whether or not we're always aware of it, the shape of our buildings shapes us. Thank you.
I was talking to an architect recently who'd been involved in designing some churches, Catholic churches, and one of the things that he said was that a lot of people, like he said, a lot of people, when they think of churches, they imagine a building that is designed for a high altar that's the back of the church. So the lines of the whole building are meant to sort of draw you there, you know, the long central aisle, that sort of thing. It seems like some churches now, like some of the ones you show, the structure of the whole building is designed for an altar that's going to be more in the center or kind of in around. And so I'm curious, can you say something about how the whole building, not just the place, but the whole building reflects, should draw our attention to the altar?
So at Notre Dame, we have a big architecture school. And one of our primary faculty members is Duncan Stroik, who has the competing journal to the one I work for, called Sacred Architecture. Okay. And we're friends, so I'm not trying to be insulting enough. We have very different ideas about this. He's very convinced that churches should be classical. And then altars should have baldacchini, you know, over them and all kinds of things. And so this church would drive him crazy. He would hate this. I sort of think of myself as a more kind of eclectic sort of person. But you're right, there's a different thinking about whether the congregation should gather around the altar or whether the congregation be sitting back there looking toward it at a distance in a sense. They're drawing your eye forward. And these are two different ways of thinking about what we're trying to do. And for Duncan, this is not reverent. For me, it is, and I think this is a problem. And so one of the texts that I drew on when I was making my argument about North African altars, and I said about this at dinner, but it's a little complicated, is Augustine, and I'm not saying he's the ending of all things. He doesn't, you know, we don't have to do what he did, but just to sort of get you into thinking about it, he talks about his two roles. And I'm your bishop and I'm your pastor or something. He preaches from on high at the back of the apse, from his throne, right?
And when the service moves from the word to the table, he says he comes down and joins the congregation. And he says, and now I am one of you. I'm not Jesus, because Jesus is currently in the Holy of Holies making the sacrifice. We're on the outside and I'm with you. And in another sermon, I can give you the references if you want to email me, he also tells people not to crowd too closely to the altar, that there seem to be coming up to it. And he says, don't crowd, don't push. And so what I imagine happens is, I think when I look at the architectural space or the archaeological space, that there was a platform that was raised a little, and it probably had a low screen around it, like we would imagine in an old church where you had this. And people came up to receive communion. And then when he says, it changes, you can see the change in the liturgy at a point when he says, turning toward the Lord. And in my almost certainty, what he means is turn toward the altar. But a lot of times you will read people arguing that this means turn to the east. But in Hippo, you can't turn to the east unless you turn your back on the altar. And I don't see people doing that, not when it has the elements on it. So I think there's a way in which everybody turns in the same direction, including the celebrant. The celebrant isn't facing the people. The celebrant is a part of the people. And I'm not trying to say this is the best way to do it. I'm just saying it is a way that makes sense to me for how he did it. Now, that would come at a more idea of people that are then facing each other. Because the people on the left side of the church are going to be looking toward the altar, and the people on the right side are looking at the altar, and they're looking at each other. They're not all looking this way. They're looking this way. So I don't know. I sometimes think these arguments are sort of about tradition, style, memories, what I did as a child, what I like, what I don't like. I like fancy. I like simple. My students, I have to admit to you, they hate this. They really do, because they love the Notre Dame Basilica. But I like this, so I try to convince them that they could imagine another kind of space. I like the Basilica too. I don't have anything really against it, although I'm famous for saying that I don't. But I don't actually say that. I just go, oh. All right. Yeah.
Thanks for your presentation. I have a question about the first part of the presentation. You're talking about the use of the baptismal font, and I'm wondering why it seems to be that one thing that wasn't reclaimed was the separate building. I was wondering if you could say more about that, why that didn't take in the circle.
So the church I belong to in Nashville, am I from Nashville here? Chris the King, when it was built in the 1940s or 50s, it had a separate octagonal baptismal chamber kind of attached to the entrance, which is now the reconciliation room. Really good use for baptismal bathroom, I think, actually. But anyway, because it's tiny, and so it was always just used for family private baptisms. And I think what the bishops wanted to happen here is that the baptism would happen as often as is practical, with the whole congregation present. And certainly when you turn to the Easter vigil baptisms, you're going to do it with the whole congregation present. If you have to, you can't troop, 300 people into these little spaces, and you want them to see it. You want them to be a part of it. So they're renewing their own baptismal promises at the same time. That's the thinking. I think originally it was in a separated space because baptism was, first of all, I think somewhat guarded in privacy, secrecy, and also that the candidates were nude. So they wanted to protect modesty.
The follow-up being then, I guess, in that particular case, unlike the other examples, the new theological vision didn't have a didn't have a historical precedent to build around in that way. The baptismal had to move entirely to accommodate in a novel way.
Right.
What happened to the idea that the baptismal water must be living water?
It's interesting. And I think as much as possible, our font should have moving water. This goes all the way back to the Didache, which talks about the water as being fresh and moving, if at all possible, spring water or rain water. And this corresponds to what a mikveh actually is supposed to be. I'm looking at my Bible's cut. Where you had to have a drain so the water was draining out and be filling it again with fresh water. You don't want stagnant water for baptism. And if it's fresh and moving, it's probably also going to be cold. It just seems funny to heat the water to me. I don't know. It's just a personal thing. So I think the feeling of that is that it's like a spring of living water, of eternal life. And it must have been hard to do that in arid climates, you know? How much water do you have? So I do sort of, I've studied the drainage systems on a lot of these fonts, and it seems like many of them have systems for draining but not systems for filling. So I sort of had this idea of a bucket brigade of like deacons and lay people kind of sitting and water. So it keeps going down while you keep refilling it. Did that get what you read? We had different.
But is that still a requirement now? Or?
I think it actually might be. I'm not sure, but I think it might be. And when Constantine built the Lateran baptistry, he built it with 7 silver stakes that were water spouts, pouring water into the font. You know, it's like, can imagine beautiful fountains and things. And we have one example I know of in Italy, in Pavia, where they were supposed to have had a canopy over the baptismal font that let rainwater fall down. Like, they must have had some sort of hydraulic system to let rain, like a shower. I think the more you can make it feel like something natural, baptism used to be outside, right?
It still is in some
places. It still is, yeah. And so you kind of want to replicate that feeling of a fresh, cleansing pool of water, a river, a flowing stream, spring water.
I'm wondering, we're talking about reclaiming older symbols. I'm wondering maybe if you have any examples of really novel symbols or examples of that history or tables that are notable in the kind of narrative frame that we've been talking about. It's just really unusual and interesting.
In Murfreesboro, Tennessee, I got into a fight because they wanted their baptismal pool to be black. And they kept saying, this is a tomb. They kept saying, well, yeah, it is, but it's also the place of rebirth. So I talked them into putting a Christogram at the base of it.
Not that you want to stand the Christogram, but you can kneel on it. And I thought, I was actually thinking about, can I find this one?
This is actually has a Cairo with an alpha and omega at the very bottom of this well. You can't see it. But it has all kinds of beautiful symbolism. This is possibly a reference to an altar or maybe a font across under a canopy. I'm sorry, I have probably about a million pictures of this one. These aren't the good ones, but there's a Holy Spirit. There's an ark. There are four blooming fruit trees. There are all kinds of fish in here. And there's a creature that might be a bee with reference to the Paschal candle. I mean, there's just so many things that you want to sort of say, let our imaginations go get rich, you know. And then I think sometimes just helping an ordinary congregation see their space. Like, again, I think about the church in Nashville. The tabernacle had the inscription on the way to the bridegroom. Nobody ever knew that. And that's a beautiful reference for the Matthean text of the virgins with their lamps coming to the temple, you know, coming to Christ, and to kind of help the congregation know that that was there. They didn't even really know, you know, what the symbols in the windows meant. So I spent a lot of time, you know, working on booklets for them. Here's what you're going to see, and here's what you pay attention to. You know, and enrich your visual and sensual experience of what's happening.